welcome to Hero Hype episode 39. As you may have guessed, I am not Danya. She is unfortunately dealing with some family issues right now. But we are excited to welcome our good friend Kristen from Hypeable back yet again for another episode of Hero Hype. Welcome, Kristen.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Yay, Hero Hype. I love talking all of these shows, so I'm very excited.
Yay. Kristen was most recently on our Deadpool episode, so
yep,
happy to have her.
No stranger.
As we said, you're an old hat at it by now.
Yeah.
Just a reminder, if you want to get in touch with us, you can find us on Twitter at Hero Hype Podcast, and you can email us at herohypepodcast@gmail.com. We always love hearing from you guys. So this week, we're going to have all of our same topics, so it's going to be slightly different order. We're not going to begin with brief history because it is for a character relevant to the movie, so we'll get into our brief history in a little bit, but we're going to start with the TV news. So there's a whole bunch going on the Marvel side this week. So our first headline is that we have a new lead character for a Netflix Marvel show. Iron Fist has cast Finn Jones from Game of Thrones as the lead in Iron Fist. So he will be playing Danny Rand, who is a skilled martial artist, and he can channel his chi into his hand, giving him superhuman strength. And he also, in the comics, has a backstory with Luke Cage, so I'm sure that'll tie into the Netflix shows, and he is the fourth main character that's going to be in the Defenders series that ends up kind of being the Netflix Avengers. So did you have any thoughts on this one, Kristen?
I mean, we've seen him on Game of Thrones. That's really the only thing I think he's done that's of note. So as far as the actor goes, he's decent. So that's usually, you know, it's fairly encouraging. But I don't really know much about the comic character. So it'll be one of those just kind of hold off and see the first episode and see how it goes.
Yeah, unfortunately, Danya's not here for this because she has far more Marvel comic book knowledge than I do. As we all know, I have a DC slant. But she has some thoughts that I'm sure she'll share in the next episode about how this, she'll be interested to see if the series is kind of introducing and deconstructing the idea of white male privilege, because it's kind of the white male character gets pulled into, like, Asian martial arts and Asian culture. So it'll be interesting to see what they do with it. But I know there were some people who were really hoping they would recast Danny as an Asian character. And there was some uproar about him being white. But then other people are saying, no, they might do something, some social commentary the way they have with their other Netflix shows. So I'm kind of reserving judgment since I have so little knowledge about this comic book story at this point. But I have mostly trusted, I can mostly trust in the Netflix crew because they've knocked the first two shows they've done out of the park.
Yeah, and we all loved Luke Cage and Jessica Jones, so I'm sure his show will be just as great. Like, I mean, I don't see any reason why it wouldn't be.
Agreed. I guess the big question is now for Game of Thrones fans as to whether his character there is still alive.
Yeah. You just, Game of Thrones, it is what it is. But, you know, nobody lives too long anyway. So.
That is very true. Also on the Marvel side, we got the second part of the season 2 Daredevil trailer. The first one was all very Punisher-centric, and then this second part was very Elektra-centric. So we see her coming back to Matt to ask for some help and being kind of flirty, and they're all fighting the Yakuza and being kick-ass and being kind of teasing. So excited?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I really liked Daredevil season 1. It was kind of a surprise for me because I didn't know if it was going to be quite my thing. I had never really liked Daredevil, the character, as much as others had. But yeah, Netflix has been knocking these series out of the park, and season 2 looks like it's going to pick up right where, you know, like it's going to pick up and be just as great as season 1 was. I was a little nervous that they were going to, you know, pull Elektra and the Punisher into this series all at once. I thought there was, you know, worry for me that things were going to get really, like, complicated and there's going to be too much to try and fit into episodes. But just from the trailers themselves, it looks like they've got a really good handle on it. So it should be great.
Agreed. It seems like they have a good sense of the story for each one and how they're going to start fitting in together. And I'm very excited, and we also like more kick-ass ladies.
Oh, yeah, always. And she is amazing in this trailer. Like, yeah.
Yeah, I like, she's very snarky and also obviously kicks some major ass, so. And it'll be
Yeah.
interesting to see, I'm sure, more of the backstory between Matt and Elektra, so. I was a little concerned because they were changing showrunners between seasons and everything. That can be a sign of not good things to come, but based on the trailers we've seen, it looks like it's going to be up to the quality of the first season.
Yeah, just the style that they've used for the trailers looks great. And yeah, showrunner changes can be really scary, but it seems to have worked here. We'll reserve full judgment until we see the series, but it looks good for now.
Yeah, so that's not very far away now, which I'm very excited about, and will probably spend like a day just locked in my room watching it.
Pretty much.
And you can rest assured we will do a special for Daredevil season two. We are always looking for excuses to do more specials. So,
Oh, yeah.
all right, so we are moving from Netflix to broadcast TV, staying with Marvel. We got the log line or synopsis for the spin-off, Marvel's Most Wanted, the Bobby and Hunter spin-off that I'm still kind of bemused by, but we'll go with it because apparently it's happening. So the log line reads, centers on Bobby Morse, aka Mockingbird, and Lance Hunter of Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., two ex-spies and ex-spouses who are on the run with no friends, no shield, and a long list of enemies looking to claim a bounty on their heads. Able to trust no one but each other, Bobby and Hunter form an uneasy alliance with Dominic Fortune, a rogue adventurer with a wealth of resources and even more adversaries, who agrees to protect them so long as they help him with his own agenda. These two heroes will help anyone in need, all while trying to uncover the conspiracy that put their own lives in jeopardy. So that sounds like there's going to be something ominous going on in the second half of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. that's going to put those two on the run.
Yeah, things don't look good for S.H.I.E.L.D. in the second half. Then again, things are never really great for Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. in the second half of their season. So, what can you really expect? Yeah. Jeez.
So I just kind of like, what could cause everybody they know to turn on them? That seems very strange. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, able to trust no one but each other? Why would you? My only guess is there's some sort of poor shield gets like infiltrated again, and rather than stick around and try and figure out who they can trust and who they can't, they take off because they know they can trust each other. Like that's the only thing I can really think of off the top of my head right now, especially with all of the inhuman stuff still. Like there's so much that could go wrong that. That's the only thing I can really come up with at the moment.
Maybe somebody like uses their form and does something really horrific. But then you would even think in that case that their friends at S.H.I.E.L.D. would be like, well, we know you wouldn't do that. So
Yeah.
I'm just trying to imagine what could make even their friends who know them at S.H.I.E.L.D. turn on them. Like that, it has to be pretty bad.
Yeah. Especially both of them. Like Hunter has
Yeah.
done some things that haven't been great, but Bobby's been pretty above board
Yeah.
from what I'm remembering. So it's like I can see why they maybe had some issues with Hunter, but Bobby, really?
Yeah, like
I don't
seeing
know.
Bobby on his side, you'd think they'd be like, okay, so clearly something's going on.
Yeah.
But.
Unless she takes his side on something that the rest of them absolutely cannot see and that separates them, who knows? But yeah. Craziness.
Yeah, so that feels like it leads to more questions than answers, but it sort of makes sense as to how they could pull those two out of the show and have it still work, like if they're on some kind of blacklist from S.H.I.E.L.D. So I guess I'm still not sure I'm super into S.H.I.E.L.D. without Bobby. Mostly I can usually give or take Hunter, but losing Bobby makes me sad, but I guess we'll have to see.
Yeah, she's been such a great addition to the show since she's arrived, and I will be very, very sad to see her leave that group. She's actually from Toledo, where I come from. Toledo, Ohio. Adrienne Palicki, the girl who plays her. So I love seeing her on TV. It's just amazing. But I will be sad to see her leave Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. even for just a little while, because it seems like they may be able to do both or make appearances, but we'll see how it goes. Again, reserve full judgment.
Yes, we just, doesn't seem like we have enough information yet, so we'll see. Okay, our last bit of news is kind of less news and more a plug. I got the chance to do an email interview, so it was basically I sent questions and got responses to Ciara Renee, who plays Kendra on Legends of Tomorrow. Danya helped me come up with the questions, so we posted that to the site, and we hope you'll go check it out. She is very thoughtful about her responses. She kind of talks about Kendra's nature and what she might do in the future, as well as just playing a female hero of color and how that's important to her. So it's really interesting, and I was really impressed with how thoughtful she was. So hopefully you guys will go check that out.
Yeah, she's one of the characters that's harder to get to know because of the crazy backstory. So I'm really glad you got a chance to like ask her some things and get into what Ciara has seen, like what she's looking at, her perspective on the character, rather than just what we've been able to get from Legends of Tomorrow and her brief, you know, appearances on Flash and Arrow. So,
yeah. All right. So that does it for our TV news. And with that, we're going to move into our TV roundup. So we're going to start with our two episodes of Agent Carter. So we're getting to the end of Agent Carter, which, and the signs pointing to it being renewed are not promising, which is really sad. But the first thing we kind of wanted to talk about, that musical number, Kristen, you put that in the doc. What were your thoughts?
I mean, can Sousa be any more like dashing in, but it just, it's something about that musical number for the start of basically the, well, it's not really the penultimate because it's the second to last, but it was a good episode, but it was so startling how that started in black and white with the whole musical thing. It was just crazy. I did enjoy it, and it was fun to hear Sousa sing and to hear Haley sing, and it was, yeah. It stood out, and I'm sure it will be one of those things that if the show doesn't get renewed, we will all look back on fondly.
And Angie was back.
Yes. Like Dottie was in there, and I think Whitney, the girl that's playing Whitney Frost, was in one of the dance numbers. Like she was, it freaked me out to see her there, but I was like, I'm sure that's her.
Yeah, that was interesting. It was definitely not what you expect from your superhero shows, especially ones that don't have all the Broadway singers and Glee characters in it on the DC side.
It's not Melissa or Grant, so you didn't necessarily see this one coming.
But yeah, so that was kind of fun, and Peggy's kind of unsure of just what she wants and who she wants, because she has options, and feel like the implication of throwing Angie in there is, you know, another option, obviously.
Yeah.
Which is great. So it was definitely interesting. And it just was kind of like, we're having way too much fun with the show, so we're going to add a musical number.
Like, Peggy's knocked out. This is the perfect opportunity. Like, come on, when else are we going to get the chance? So, yeah, why not? Go for it.
I'm kind of amused by the implication that, like, her thought process is a musical number. I like that that's kind of what it tells us about Peggy.
Yeah, really. I mean, if you think about it, that's really good fun. I like that she thinks in musical numbers. She dreams in musical numbers.
Yeah. That's quality. I enjoy it. Kind of another thing going on this season, well, these two episodes, is Wilkes, who was kidnapped by Whitney Frost at the end of the last two episodes. It starts to get hard to track where the two episodes end because there's just so much. But Wilkes is kidnapped, and in these episodes, Whitney is kind of experimenting on him, which seems initially like super evil, and she's like torturing him. But then she sort of just like turns over her research and is like, aren't I brilliant? Like, she's looking for validation, which is kind of sad when you think about it.
Yeah, the whole Whitney Wilkes dynamic in these two episodes was kind of strange because, yeah, she had all the cards and held all the power, and she basically hands it over to him because she's hoping that everything that's happening to her is also happening to him. And it's like she suddenly just needs someone else to be in her shoes and to know what's going on. And then, you know, then they're standing in the desert and he is sucked up into the zero matter and she's left behind. And then, you know, you kind of see her, like, the panic and all of that. And yeah, their arc in these two episodes was rather strange, kind of weird. I didn't see it coming prior to this, so I don't know. But I mean, Wilkes hasn't been my favorite part of this season anyway, so
I like him as a person, but I just am a little disappointed with his complete lack of agency all season. Like, I mean, I guess,
like,
that's
quite literally.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's reflective of the fact that he's a black male in a very even overtly racist time period. So he is marginalized as much as the women are, if not more, for his race. So that reflects that in some way. But at the same time, he was set up to be kind of a big player, and then he's kind of just been completely reactive this whole time. And then these two episodes end with, you know, he turns on Peggy, but he's only doing it because he's really just trying to figure out what's going on with him and he wants answers. So that's the first time he really gets to act on his own since the bomb exploded on him and made him in, like, see through. But then, like, at the end of the episode, he comes in at Whitney and I assume he, like, dies when he, like, blows up.
Yeah, the end of that episode, so weird. I don't know if that is the end of Wilkes or whether, because he was almost purely, like, zero matter at that point, whether he's going to be able to restructure himself, like, reform. I don't know.
And if he is almost completely zero matter, is he really even himself anymore anyway?
Right. Yeah, so, that would be the other question.
Because he could be, like, theoretically dead at that point. Just his body is being animated. I don't know. It was strange, but that sort of, if I read it like a death scene, and maybe it wasn't, but it felt to me just that was kind of a sad cherry on top of how little he's been able to do for himself the whole season. And I was kind of rooting for him and Peggy to have a little thing because he was not shy about how much he liked her and she clearly liked him. And with Sousa off not able to get his head straight with anything, I was totally into this really cute, sweet guy being totally into Peggy. But he kind of, I've been underwhelmed with what they've done with him, I guess.
Yeah, it wasn't, I agree with you. Underwhelmed is the word because he didn't do quite what I thought was going to be done with his character. And the whole, like, not just invisible, but, like, not being able to touch things or interact with things, like, that was really strange, and it cut down on a lot of what they were so focused on fixing the scientific part of that I feel like lost a lot of the interpersonal stuff between him and Peggy and what could have been. But yeah, he was definitely an interesting addition, but it didn't take it to the next, like, it didn't push it to the next level like I thought it would.
Yeah, but a character who I think has gone through a very strong arc, especially his last couple episodes, is Jarvis, who he goes through some major emotional swings in these episodes. Anna thankfully doesn't die, because Donnie and I decided if she did, we were going to riot, so no rioting necessary. But she was hurt to the point that she's no longer able to have children. There were some complications with her injuries, and now she can't have children. And Jarvis is pretty much unable to tell her, and he focuses his pain and his rage about that kind of lost future onto Whitney, and he shoots her point blank. Like, he would have become a murderer if Whitney wasn't full of zero matter and just revived, which is kind of like, oh, whoa, Jarvis.
Yeah, like, just, I mean, I guess you can see it coming, but, oh, and Peggy's anger at him after that whole encounter was crazy. Just totally justified and totally expected. But just watching her and Jarvis, you know, her being so furious with him over what he did, and you know, her like explaining, like, you murdered her. I don't care who she is or what she did. Like, you walked up and shot her. Like, it's not okay. It was definitely unexpected of Jarvis, that's for sure.
He just looked when Peggy's like walking away from him and he reveals the truth that Anna can't have kids. Like, he looked so defeated and beaten down and just broken in that moment. And my heart just broke for him because, you know, he has his wife who he loves and she's alive, but it's clear he would be very good with children. And I think he would be a great father. So that kind of, he just has lost that potential future. And it's really, he really portrayed that so well in that moment. My heart broke.
Yeah, I mean, when you think of Jarvis, especially on Agent Carter, what we love so much about him is the silly and the one-liners and the stuff that him and Peggy get into that they manage to get their way out of. Like, you think about the scenes at the beginning of this season with him with, like, the judo and the weightlifting that we all loved and were, you know, we giggled about. And then to see in this moment, in this scene, like, how far Jarvis has fallen in so quick, such a quick time period, like, between Anna getting shot to now, like, he's had a lot of things, like, bombard him all at once. So it was really, really sad. Yeah, when he finally let the truth go and Peggy kind of turns around, it, yeah, it just breaks you, because Jarvis is such a good, happy, you know, bubbly guy most of the time, that to see him broken like that was really, really hard.
And we viewers know that he'll take part in raising Tony eventually, but he doesn't know that. He doesn't know he will at least have a child to be part of their life. So it's definitely sad. But I think It was very well written, very well acted, and it was very believable for me that he would just take all of that heartbreak and turn it like that.
Yeah.
All right, so there's a whole lot more going on, but we're going to move on to our DC side for time's sake. So let's start with Supergirl. So this week we get the sister of Glee's Sebastian Smythe, apparently, when Kat hires a second assistant who actually is now the first assistant. So we're going full on The Devil Wears Prada with Siobhan Smythe, the two assistants now, and Siobhan is working very hard to undermine Kara and keep her down so she can, like, work her way up the ladder and become the next Cat Grant, which is, you gotta love a girl with ambition, but you don't gotta love a girl who puts other girls down.
Yeah, I was really excited to see Italia Ricci because I love her, and to see her, I knew she was coming up, like, she had some stuff coming up on Supergirl, but she did well. The character is a bit, she's a bit much. I'm sure we'll be seeing more of her in the next few episodes, but
it's pretty.
No, you're okay. She is very reminiscent of, like, the worst parts of Cat Grant.
Yeah, I can see that. It's interesting to me that Kat goes behind Kara's back to hire this new assistant. Like, that's how bad Kara is in the doghouse at this point, from, you know, she's keeps missing work and then, like, had Jean pretending to be her and was doing a very bad job when she quote unquote was at her job. And so Kara is just, the point she is at in her job and with Kat is so bad that she has to bring in this other assistant. It's kind of amazing that she isn't fired on the spot. And it's like, I hired your replacement.
Yeah, really. You would expect Kat to just fire her. So it's a little, this is almost more punishment. Like, this is Kat trying to get a dig at her even more than just hiring her replacement. Like, she's put some time and energy into Kara / Kira / whatever she calls her, and so, like, you can tell she's put a little bit of time and energy into her, so she doesn't necessarily want to just, like, fire her and get rid of her, but she needs to make her life a living hell for a while, so she's hired this really obnoxious, like, you know, a pain in the ass girl to help out. And yeah, should be interesting.
Who pan presses coffee picked from the shade of guava trees.
Like, oh, seriously?
I can't help but wonder if Kat is still not 100% convinced that Kara isn't Supergirl and that she's maybe keeping her around out of that suspicion.
Yeah, I agree. I never thought that Kat fully believed her eyes and what was happening in that scene. Like, seeing the both of them in the same room, I don't think was enough to really convince her.
And I mean, like, on the spot, she's very startled, but I imagine, like, with that brilliant journalist mind whirling afterwards, she's probably going, wait, we live in a world with aliens, like, and my former protege got struck by lightning and got electricity powers, like, it doesn't seem that far out of reach that someone might take her form. So, I feel like Kat is too smart to just completely dismiss it. So I wonder if, I mean, besides the plot convenience of having Kara keep her job, that I wonder if Kat is still suspicious, but she can't prove it because she thought she had the two of them in the same place at the same time. So I really hope they bring her in on it at some point, because really, like, having Kat know would be only to Kara's benefit.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, she doesn't seem to want to... When the series began, like, at the very beginning, I would have been worried about Kat finding out. But seeing and learning what we have about Kat, she's not trying to necessarily use Supergirl. Like, she wants to use the things she's doing, but I don't think she would go behind her back or, like, try to manipulate her to do things or all that sort of stuff. Like, she would literally be a really great asset to Kara, I think. So hopefully down the road here, we do see her kind of brought into the fold.
Yeah, I think Kat, like, is trying to craft her image in a protective way. And I think that goes to the story that she tells James in this episode about when she was working as a gossip columnist. She was supposed to write a piece about this famous star, and she interviewed everybody around him, and they were like, oh, he's the greatest, so nice. And then she interviewed the makeup artist who told her about all the bruises and everything and how he was actually really violent and abusive. And Kat succumbed to pressure and wrote the puff piece. And then a few months later, he shot his girlfriend. So she's really haunted by that. And I have to wonder if the way Kat is very protective of other women, as we've seen, doesn't stem from that. Like, it would make a lot of sense to me.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's very much in her character now that we've gotten to know her better for her to, like, nurture rather than manipulate. Like, she's more there. She wants to help. She wants to be a part of it. And I could see her being brought into the fold somewhere down the line here, I hope.
Yeah, I mean, like, she was trying to get rid of Kara, like, when she thought she was Supergirl. But I imagine if Kara says, look, I am Supergirl, but having my job here helps me feel human and more connected to the people of the city, so I really need this job. Like, if she just explained what she tells everybody else, I'm sure she'd be allowed to keep her job, but then maybe Kat would hire the other assistant, and it's just like, oh, she runs errands a lot or something. So comic book, like, logic.
Like, if Kara just says, listen, I'm still, like, a person and I have to pay rent, so I need a job. I can't just be Supergirl. That doesn't pay all that great. Like, listen, I'm pretty sure Kat would get the get the hint.
Yeah, like, communication, who needs it?
Yeah, really.
The other part of this episode was kind of an exploration of whether kind of the ends justify the means in a lot of ways. And Kara is kind of stuck in a phase for a while where she's really willing to do what is necessary, particularly in terms of keeping Maxwell Lord locked up. And James, after a confrontation with Lucy, when Lucy realizes that he knows about the DEO, he has this confrontation with Kara and is like, this is not the girl I know, like, who is not willing to, the girl I know is not willing to do all this. And Kara really struggles against it until she kind of sees that Max matched up against the black and white of Master Jailer and the way he's, like, executing people who were imprisoned for fairly minor offenses, and he doesn't care. So It seems like that's kind of finally what brings her around. But I'm wondering, do we think that it's in character for Kara to be feeling this way? Or did that ring weird to you?
Yeah, the conversation and the interplay between her and James in that scene where they had this discussion was really great. But I feel I've had issue with her and Astra's death and her dealing with that and what that's done to, like, how she's reacted to other people. Like, it's hard for us as viewers to be like, yeah, Maxwell Lord should be free. What are you talking about? But when you hear James say all the things he says, it does make you think. Like, he's a, you know, Lord is a human being, and he's being held in a facility that's, you know, been created to handle the alien threats, and is it okay for them to just take him off the street and put, you know, lock him away, even though he's not necessarily full of greatness that we really want, you know, on the street. So it was a really tough episode for me. I there are parts of it that just don't necessarily feel true to what Kara's done, but since she's still struggling with Astra's death and all of that, like, things aren't necessarily always going to feel in character when a character's grieving like that. Sometimes you do things and you lash out and you react differently than you normally would.
True, though they locked him up before Astra's death, and Kara went with it before then. But yeah, I think she's kind of going along with it because, you know, Alex thinks it's right too. But Alex is kind of extreme in her own rights, Alex is, of course, allowing Hank to lie about being the one to kill Astra, and Kara is lashing out at him, which is completely undeserved, but she doesn't know that. And I think that's super sad for Hank / Jean, because we know that Jean lost his wife and daughters, and he was starting to build this kind of little makeshift family with Alex and Kara, and now he sacrifices that to protect the relationship between Kara and Alex, which I think for him is this really huge sacrifice, but is also going to bite both him and Alex in the butt when Kara finds out.
Yeah, clearly.
Oh, well. I think there was a deleted scene in this episode, too, because there is one of the promotional stills was released was in the scene where Kara is basically telling Siobhan she doesn't like her. And there's a shot of Maxwell Lord, like, standing with them. So, like, he's been let out of the DEO and he, like, apparently comes to Catco or something. And I'm going, so I kept waiting for that scene and it never happened. And I'm like, what happened to this scene? What was happening?
It's one of those, it made it to the trailer, but not the episode, so now what do I do? Like, yeah, situations. We've had those before, but yeah, that is kind of strange.
But I'm sure we will see plenty more drama going on there.
Oh, yeah.
Let's move on to The Flash. So this episode is, we're using the word delightful to talk about, like, the Earth 2 stuff, and I just find the whole Jaws thing also very delightful, because it was ridiculous.
Oh my god, all of Cisco's Jaws references made me, like, ecstatically happy. I can't even tell you. The "we're gonna need a bigger Flash" line, and, like, it just, oh my god. As much as I love Cisco to begin with, this episode was just even better. It was so much fun. Like, and this then, episode was the kind of fun you expect from The Flash.
And then Diggle and Lila come over, which mm-hmm. is great, because I love the dynamic between Diggle and Barry, because Diggle just is never quite over the fact that Barry has powers. And it's just, he's always amazed by it, and I love it so much. And I think Diggle is also the perfect person to show up in Barry's life at this time, because Barry is dealing with everything that happened in Earth 2, and through the episode, he is not dealing very well, like, at all. And so Diggle, who sees everything he sees with Oliver in terms of, like, carrying the world on the shoulders, he sees it in Barry, and is like, you cannot let this eat you alive, which is like, trust me, I've seen it in Star City. It doesn't work very well. So he's just such a good presence, and I always love him with Lila. So I quite enjoyed him being on The Flash.
Yeah, I loved that Lila had a very similar reaction to Barry. Like, yeah, that's still weird. Like, her and Dig kind of see things the same way, which, love, love, love. And yeah, it was really nice to have Diggle in this episode for all the reasons you just said. Like, he's seen Oliver go through this, you know, guilt gut stuff before, and to see, you know, he sees it on Barry, and Barry's not used to trying to bear the weight of the world. So, you know, to see him, you know, sunk down by all of that extra weight, like, yeah, I was really happy to see Diggle around. It wasn't just a crossover for crossover's sake. It was a really well-timed moment to have Diggle in the mix for this.
Yes, I completely agree. And, oh, I just lost my train of thought there. I had something else to say about Diggle. Oh, because Oliver is really bad about leaning on other people, which is something that Barry is very good at for the most part, which is probably why he really hasn't had that issue up until now, when they're like, when Wells, who is so unhelpful, like, I just, that man is not helpful.
Harry.
Yeah. When he's like, you can't tell them about what you saw on Earth 2. I'm like, why? Like, there's literally no point to this.
It's not the future. It's another world. Yeah. It has no effect on their characters at all. I was so confused with that, too. I was like, telling Caitlin that in another world, she's a crazy metahuman is not going to make her a crazy metahuman. Like, yeah. No.
It was forced drama. And he has done this more than once this season that has caused drama that was completely unnecessary by, like, he did it with Barry and Patty when Barry wanted to tell Patty the truth. And everyone was on board except Harry. And then Barry, for some reason, takes Harry's advice and doesn't tell Patty. When if he had, Patty would have probably joined Team Flash and everything would be even more wonderful than it already is. So,
and we would love her even more than we already did.
I'm just going to be forever bitter about that.
I know. But I love Patty too.
But Harry is just, he's full of this horrible advice, and Barry takes it, and eventually he comes clean, and Sisko comes clean about what they saw. But I don't know, it's really sad to see Barry, like, I'm just like, can we stop making Barry cry at some point? Like, Grant Gustin has proven he's very good at it, but do we need to keep doing it? Why are we making the puppy cry? Like, it's so sad. Yeah.
Apparently there's a meme going around, or a meme going around, where, like, it's like sad Flash and people are trying to cheer him up. Like, it's like him sitting on the street corner with his legs out and he's kind of pouting. I don't know. I haven't actually looked at it, but I keep seeing it on Twitter. Like, like fans on Tumblr are trying to cheer up the Flash. And I'm like, oh, poor Barry. So I love that.
Yeah. But one of the people who suffers from Barry's attitude issue in this episode is Wally, who Iris and Joe are trying to get to come together with Barry because they're going to be a family. Like, Barry is as much Joe's son as Wally is at this point. So they're like, you know, you two should get to know each other. And Barry, his attitude issues at this point, is not dealing with the Earth 2 stuff. He just does not do well. And Wally is very offended, but he's also kind of jealous. And which is too bad, because I think those two could actually be good friends if people would get their heads out of their butts.
Yeah, I liked the stuff, like, that first interaction between them where Barry was just sullen, and it wasn't that he didn't want to get to know Wally, it's just in his head. And that interaction wasn't my favorite, but, like, as the episode wore on and we saw them, you know, in scenes, and we got Joe talking to Wally and explaining, like, why and how Barry became a member of the family, and that all of that was really interesting for me. Like, I have always loved the West family dynamic, like, just seeing how they function and how Barry is a part of the family in basically every way. Even with Wally coming into the picture, like, they still want Barry to, you know, they want Wally to see Barry as a brother, just as, you know, Iris has grown up with Barry and all of that. So I really liked this episode for that. I loved all of that. Like, that's the good kind of drama for me. The only issue I had was that whole King Shark, you know, shows up and rips the living room roof off, which was crazy in itself. But Wally, of course, after the fact, yells at Barry and calls him a coward. I'm like, how about you just think for 30 seconds about how Barry disappeared and then the Flash appears and then the Flash disappears and Barry's back?
Like, come on. Like, use your brain for 30 seconds.
And when King Shark has been like, I know the Flash is here, and, like, the only people in the room are the Stark Barry and you. Like,
yeah, like, come on. It was so mad. I was like, well, just put it together. Because things always get better once everyone knows what's going on, and it's only a matter of time before Wally finds out. So, you know, I was like, just put it together and figure it out and confront Barry about it, and everything will be fine. And yeah, no. Instead, he decided to call him a coward and be really mean. Sigh.
But that was still him, like, dealing with his jealousy, which I think makes sense, because Barry is sort of the golden child in the family, and he's not even blood related, and Wally's trying to figure out what his place here is going to be, and he probably already feels like his place maybe is filled by someone who's not even actually related to them. So I can understand, like, him being a little nervous about it, but I like what Joe says. It's just like, I am so protective of that kid, so I might come over a little, like, over enthusiastic, but it's just because I'm proud of him and I'm protective of him, which I thought was really sweet.
Just Joe and Barry, they just melt my heart every week, so.
Okay, but the big thing we need to talk about that has just, instead of giving answers, just has more questions, is the Zoom reveal. So at the very end of the episode, we see Zoom return to his lair, and he's got Jay's body in his arms. And the guy in the iron mask, like, sees him walk in and, like, freaks out. Like, he does not know what's going on, freaking out. And then Zoom pulls his mask off, and there's Jay, who the producers have said, you know, is Hunter Zolomon. So I was, my theory was that there were twins involved, but I guess that Jay maybe wasn't ever Jay. He's always been Hunter Zolomon, which is interesting. But then I'm like, okay, but the big theory is also that the real Jay is the one in the iron mask. So who is the Jay that just got murdered? Who is the Jay, quote unquote, that's Zoom? And then who's the dude in the mask? I am so confused right now.
Yeah, pretty much. I had assumed there was either some sort of twin twist thing going on, or there was a clone, or we were looking at another, you know, speedster from the future is, you know, in on Earth 2, blah, blah, blah. Like, I had assumed there had to have been, like, another, and now seeing him in, you know, seeing Zoom take the mask off, it's like, okay, now how do we have, like, three of them?
Yeah, because that wasn't, like, Jay getting murdered wasn't a speed illusion like they did with Wells and the Reverse Flash, because he's actually carrying the body and he, like, drops the body on the ground. So there was actually somebody that he killed. So, like,
question mark?
I'm very confused. I mean, maybe, like, I don't know. And then who's, like, is one of them, like, from Earth 1 and one's Earth 2? Maybe there's a complete other Earth that there's pathway from. I feel like this just makes more questions rather than gives answers.
Yeah, really. I have so many more questions after seeing the mask come off, because Karen and I, after last week's episode, you know, we had tried to play, like, Zoom / Jay Garrick hopscotch and tried to figure out if Jay is the guy, and, you know, if he is Zoom, then how is he also Jay Garrick on Earth 1? And we saw that Hunter Zolomon is on Earth 1. And, you know, like, we were trying to put all the pieces together. And, yeah, so we have no idea. Now, knowing that it is him, because we were trying to figure out if it could have been, now that we know that it is him in some form, that now, yeah, who knows?
I'm still just, it seems like we're, like, there needs to be, like, a third Jay / Hunter Zolomon somewhere that is fitting into this equation, because it just, like, if he hadn't been carrying a body, you could have been like, okay, it's been a speed illusion, but except, like, you know, Zoom was also on the complete other side of the breach before he kills Jay, and Jay was completely on Earth 1 at the exact same time. Yeah. So there's two of them, and then there's the guy in the mask who may not be a Jay, but a lot of theories seem to think that's the real Jay who we've never even met, because it would be pretty ballsy to make, like, the original Flash a villain. Like,
yeah.
I'm so confused.
It's so confusing. I mean, I know that after watching, Karen and I thought slash still think that the guy in the Iron Mask was Diggle or Andy Diggle, which is a bit of a stretch, but based on what we had heard and learned from him, we thought that that was a possibility. Now I'm kind of wondering if maybe that couldn't be Wally, Earth 2 Wally, just because we didn't see his doppelganger at all, and we know that Wally West also has some Speedster origin story stuff. So I don't know.
I think I had thought that the guy in the mask was African American based on the skin color, but there was a shot in the previous episode of his profile and you could see the back of his neck and a little hair, and it looked like he had Caucasian skin and blonde hair.
Oh, great.
Which is why a lot of people think it's Jay. So I think like the lighting and how dirty he was.
Yeah.
But yeah. I thought that too. I was thinking Diggle or Wally, but then people were like, no, if you look at his neck and his hair, it's completely different. Okay. I had to go back and look, and then I was like, oh, apparently.
Now I'll be curious enough. I'll have to go look myself.
Yeah. Yeah, there's just a brief shot. Like, I think it's when Barry is saying, I'll come back for you or something.
Okay.
A shot of him in profile, and you can see a little bit. So okay. I think they were using lighting really effectively to disguise also, who he could be. So overall, super confusing.
Yep. Thanks, Flash.
And now it's off for 3 weeks. So
so we'll just stew in our confusion until it comes back.
Exactly. But we also have Arrow. This episode, I feel like, was very meh, except for Vixen, who was fabulous. I thought she was great. I was very concerned about how they were going to translate her powers from animation, which is very free to, show the animal she's manifesting. And I was like, how are they going to do this in live action? And I thought they knocked it out of the park. I thought it looked great. She was great. I love that she has a good dynamic with Oliver and Barry. They're kind of not on good terms in the animated series because she's just finding out she has these powers, and then they're chasing her down and she's like, get away from me. But they've apparently become friends. So I like that they have Oliver and Mari were very comfortable with each other, which I loved. I cracked up at the part where she's sniffing the Flash figure and is like, don't you dare tell Barry about this.
Lost it. Yeah, that was fabulous.
So, and I love that she got her own big damn hero moment where she's the one to destroy the totem and get rid of Damien Dark's magic. I thought she was great, and I really would like to see her more in live action.
Yeah, she was great from start to finish. They gave her a lot to do in this episode. She wasn't just someone who showed up and, they haven't always used guest stars to the best of their ability, but they really used her well, and I would be happy to see her return anytime.
Yeah. Did you watch the animated series?
No, I've seen the first episode, or maybe the first two, because they showed them at Comic-Con on DC Night in Hall H. But I haven't seen the whole series yet, so it's on my to-do list. I just haven't done it yet.
Definitely do it. It's only half an hour for all 6 episodes.
Oh, cool.
And
yeah, I know I've seen the first one, but
it's pretty great, and we're getting a second season, so I'm excited. This episode, otherwise besides Vixen, who we agree was wonderful, was kind of played out pretty much exactly how I expected it to, in terms of the reveal of Oliver having a child, and Felicity literally says, I don't care that you have a child, I care that you didn't tell me, which is exactly how I thought she would react. And I understand that she put you in a tough situation when Samantha actually tells her I told him to do this. So she's like, I get it, that doesn't mean I'm not angry, and I feel like you don't think you can trust me, which kind of goes back to Oliver still having problems leaning on other people when he needs them. And Felicity gives her ring back. We'll get to the part that happens right after in a second, but we could just talk about the drama there. Was that how you thought that was going to play out?
I mean, yeah, I had hoped that maybe she would just give him this one. when the whole thing went down with Samantha a while back, and you know, Ollie made the deal and said he wasn't going to tell anyone, I'm sitting there thinking, how is she going to know if you told Felicity? Like, seriously.
Exactly.
In what world is she going to know that you told your fiance? So it never made sense to me that Barry didn't tell her. It seemed like a stretch that he would keep that a secret from Felicity, but he did. So I don't blame Felicity for being upset about it, even after, you know, hearing all the reasoning and hearing from Samantha exactly what happened. It's between her and Barry, or it's between her and Oliver. Like, he should have told her. It's that simple. Like, there's no reason not to tell her. And this, you know, he doesn't have any allegiance to Samantha. William, yes, but not, you know, he doesn't really have a reason to keep all of Samantha's secrets. Like, so it seemed really strange that he chose her over Felicity in that scenario anyway. But, you know, I'm happy that Felicity's just not taking this and, you know, and just saying, whatever, you know, Barry, I'll forgive you, I forgive you, I forgive you, because Oliver, she's done that before. God, I keep doing that. I did that the other day in conversation. For some reason, I keep inserting Barry into this situation. Anyway, but yes, Oliver. But yeah, I'm actually really glad that she gave the ring back. I think he needs to do some serious soul searching, and, like, figure out what it is he wants, and can he truly, like, be with her? Because if he's going to be with her, she wants him to be there, not, you know, keep playing games like he has been.
Yeah, and I think that I saw some backlash against Felicity, but I feel like it wasn't just this instance. Like, if this had been the only time and she had understood the context, she would have been like, okay, I get it. But it's because Oliver has this history of only telling people things that he thinks they need to know when he thinks they need to know it. He just doesn't, like we said earlier, know how to rely on people very well and bring them in on what he's going through. And like Felicity says, you know, marriage is a partnership. Marriage is leaning on your partner when you need them. And if you are not able to do that, this is not going to be a healthy relationship. So I need you to figure that out before we move forward with this. So I think it's because of the pattern more than this specific instance too.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not as if, I mean, she's not trying to get him back or anything like that. It's just, he needs to really figure out where his priorities are and what's, you know, what's important to him, and whether this is, you know, Felicity needs to be a priority if that's what he wants. So he now needs to figure that out, and she's going to give him the space and time to do that. So
yeah,
I say it works. Yeah, it's not great, but, you know, you deal.
I mean, I think it makes sense in Oliver, for as much as he has developed this season, like, he's leaps and bounds ahead of where he has been, but he still has work to do. So
oh, yeah.
I don't blame Felicity, because Oliver has this pattern of troubling behavior. So, but Donnie and I have talked about this before, and I wrote a piece on it for Hypeable about why this should not happen. But at the end of the episode, the beginning of the episode is they've put the spinal implant in for Felicity, and I thought it was really cute that she was at physical therapy with Curtis's husband.
Yeah. Like,
I love that they keep bringing him back, and they're not shy about what their relationship is. So I think that's great. I love that. But they were setting up, Felicity is walking again at the end of the episode, like, while she's yelling at Oliver, basically, like, her foot moves, and then she stands up, amazing, and kind of just walks
in her heels.
Yeah. And she walks out of the apartment, like, kind of unsteady, but she walks. And my first thought is, ugh, they went there, because there's so many reasons they should not have gone there this short of a time after she was hurt. But also, Oliver, you don't know how long those effects are going to last. She could close the door and fall on her face. I know she asked for space, but just say, I'm worried that that might not last, so can I just make sure you get to where you're going? Like,
well, and originally, like, okay, I saw the scene. I kind of expected something like this to happen. When her foot just started to move, I was like, okay, they're going there. I expected them to use the empty wheelchair as, like, a thing for Oliver to focus on. Like, Felicity is literally not here. Like, she's here. Her wheelchair is sitting in front of me, but she has left. And I was expecting them to use that as, like, him figuring things out, like, him thinking things through. But they didn't. They never went back to the empty wheelchair. Like, they just left. She walks out, closes the door, and cut, you know? And it bugged me. I was like, there's no reason. And yeah, I thought the same thing. Like, logistically, she could fall over at any moment, and he's just gonna let her walk out. Like, no.
Like, I get that she asked you for space, but on a logical spectrum, it's like, you know, you haven't been walking in how long? Like, I just want to make sure you're okay. The thing might not work as well as we think it's going to. Like, or call somebody to be like, Felicity's walking and she's by herself. Please go find her. Like,
hey, Laurel. Yeah. Thea, anybody?
Somebody, please.
Felicity's pissed and she's walking. So if someone could just, you know,
make sure she doesn't hurt herself, that'd be great.
Yeah.
Agreed. But the fact that she's walking again, like, 4 episodes after she was supposedly paralyzed for the rest of her life just drives me up the wall. Like, I assumed at some point they would have her walk again, which is problematic, but kind of logistically I can understand. But to do it such a short time after her injury not only, like, undercuts the stakes of the story with Damian Dark, it also is super insulting to people, like, who have disabilities, because they're basically like, get over it. This is fixable, which that's actually not true. Like, Felicity was doing okay. She had kind of overcome her demons after the accident to kind of be functional again. She was adjusting. And that is a great message, and it's an inclusive message. So the fact that they were like, no, but she needs to walk. She really needs to be fixed, like, three, four episodes right after. Like, that really bothers me.
Yeah, for me, that was my biggest complaint. I knew especially after Curtis presented them with the chip, I knew she was going to eventually walk again. But it seems pointless to have made her crippled and then poof, ta-da, magic cure 4 episodes later. Mm-hmm. Now Felicity can walk again. Everything's fine. It's like, why did we go through all this? Like, exactly. Why is this even a thing that happened? It makes no sense. Unless somehow that chip is going to, you know, short circuit or go haywire or something, and it's going to cause her actual permanent loss, and eventually she is bound to the chair. Like, I could see that being a thing down the line, but it just, with all of this happening within, like, 3 or 4 episodes, it seems like such a pointless storyline. We did get some really great Felicity stuff because of the accident and her wanting to walk down the aisle and that being something that, you know, affects her. And we got the whole episode with her, like, trying to adjust and get used to her new reality. Like, that's all great. But when you give the instant cure, you know, 2 episodes after that, then what's the point?
Yeah, exactly. Like, there was literally no difference. And I think it probably would have been more powerful if they were just like, she's really hurt, she will recover, but it's going to take a while. And then we saw her, like, in the chair for a while. And then we saw her, like, on crutches or with a cane or a walker or something. And, like, in physical therapy between things. So we see her, like, process of healing. Like, it would have gotten you to the same point, but without really cheapening what happened.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've seen not the same injury, but similar injury with Raven on the 100, and they've shown the progression of her, like, healing or learning to deal with it and all of that. So I don't see why they couldn't have gone down that sort of, you know, train of thought rather than giving her the full on, you know, lower body paralysis and then, you know, just here, magically, magic cure, you can walk again, ta-da. Like, that, yeah, it bugs me.
Yeah, I think the word here is cheapens. It cheapens everything. And yeah, I'm very unhappy about that. But at least Vixen was great.
Yes.
And I was kind of noticing that there were so many more women than men in the Arrow Cave in this episode. And I was like, wow, for all of Arrow's issues, it has done so much better with, like, it's dealing with women. Like, obviously it still has problems, but it's doing so much better than The Flash with women.
I mean, yeah, you've had a lot of really great characters. And yeah, this episode, they did kind of take over, which was fabulous.
I loved it. Okay, and then we have our final episode to talk about, which is Legends of Tomorrow, which I was very excited for this episode because this was Star City 2046. So the team ends up in Star City 30 years in the future. So we get to see a whole bunch of throwbacks and references to the Arrowverse and some hints about what had happened in the time that had passed. And we see, like, the old Oliver, who was based on the Dark Knight Returns look. He's got the beard and is missing an arm, which, so hi, Stephen Amell. It was good to see him. I enjoyed seeing that. What did you think of old Ollie?
The look was kind of strange just because, and Karen and I thought the same thing, his beard almost looked CGI'd when we knew it wasn't. Like, we knew it was practical and that they had given him a beard, but the way it, like, the coloring was done in that room in the lighting, it looked CGI, so it kept bugging me. But I liked having old Ollie there. Like, his presence was really cool in the episode, and seeing him interact with Sarah and kind of, like, that was all great. Just the look kind of bugged me a little bit.
Well, I enjoyed him. It was sad to see that he had become so defeated and broken with all that going on. And the implication is that, well, basically straight up says that because Sarah and Ray never come back, is why this all is allowed to happen. Like, there's no telling if it could have happened or not, but they could have been the tipping point to stopping this whole thing. So, huge amount of guilt there. But we had a few other references to the Arrowverse. Our new Green Arrow, Connor Hawk, who in the comics is Oliver's son, is not Oliver's son, but he's actually Diggle's son.
Whoa.
Which I thought was great.
Sean Diggle Jr.
But he doesn't think he deserves that name.
Aww.
But no mention of the other child of Sarah, which made me a little sad. Because I thought Sarah should have been like, look, your sister was named after me, okay?
Like, where is she? Come on now.
But that was good. We had Deathstroke was Grant Wilson, Slade Wilson's son. And somehow he knew that Sarah was a League of Assassins trained assassin at some point, which I was like, how did you know that? But whatever.
I only guessed that maybe the legend that was, you know, Sarah, like maybe Sarah Lance's legend kind of became bigger than she was. And so people knew that was, I kind of questioned that. It's like, how did he know that?
Wonder if like Slade got off the island at some point, the island prison, and like told his family about it, like, because I'm pretty sure that we knew Slade had a son, but I don't think his name was Grant. So it seems like he got off Leon Yu at some point to have another child who would become the new Deathstroke.
Like, yeah, especially considering like his age compared to John Diggle Jr.'s age and it being 2046. I assumed that he had to have gotten off the island and had a child.
Yeah, so maybe like Slade told him about like the Team Arrow that he had fought, and he's like, and there was Sarah who was trained by the League of Assassins or whatever. Like, that's the only thing I can think of. But yeah, so I assume he got off the island at some point, like the timing worked. And also what I think is interesting is the timing with Connor's age seems to imply that Diggle is not in the grave on Arrow.
Because he
would have to be born probably, I don't know, another 5 years from now-ish to be as old as he appeared to be in 2046, which means that Diggle could not be in the grave for him to be his son. And he says that, you know, my father is dead because I wasn't there, which implies that Connor would have been older when Diggle died.
Yeah, would have been old enough to have helped and or caused something to have happened. So, yeah.
So my takeaway from that was, at least in that timeline, Diggle isn't in the grave. I'm not sure like at what point they start diverging, but my takeaway there is like, okay, Diggle should not be in the grave based on this, hopefully. We had, what else do we have from the Arrowverse? Smoke Technologies Felicity took over Palmer Tech.
I know there was like an influx of people asking Mark Guggenheim on Twitter what Felicity's birthday was. And I assumed that it was because Oliver told them that, like, the passcode to the warehouse was 4587. And I assumed that people thought that that may have been her birthday or that it was someone, like, specific and important's birthday. But I couldn't figure out who would have had that. You know,
I did looking around. I was like, is this Felicity's? Is this Oliver's? Is this like the date the first issue of The Dark Knight Returns was published? Like that was published in 86. So that doesn't work. I was like, that is that clearly a date, but I don't know what date it is. And I tried to dig around and I could not figure out what the date was. So,
yeah. Just one of those lingering mysteries that if we ever get a reference to it again, it'll pop back in our minds, I'm sure.
Or if any of you listeners have any idea what that date was a reference to, let us know. We appreciate it.
Absolutely.
But for me, what was really interesting, because Sarah is kind of at the center of this episode. She really reacts to the whole thing badly. But I find it very interesting because she's always been very much a wanderer type character. And she doesn't really have a loyalty to a place, but her loyalty is to her loved ones. So I guess her, you know, real reaction is to, you know, the loved ones that are clearly dead at this point. But I was very intrigued that she, like Ray also lived in Star City, and he does not take it nearly as bad, as Sarah does.
Yeah, she, her reaction to it was way more intense than I expected it to be.
Yeah, because she's not super loyal to just like the city, but I guess if it's her loyalty is more to people, and if she's going, okay, everyone that I care about must be dead for this to have happened, that I can see really bothering her. But it was interesting, and I enjoyed her, and I enjoyed seeing her and Oliver back together again, at least for a little while.
Yeah.
But, and Leonard's snart was also a very enjoyable piece in this episode. He continues to have my favorite arc in the entire Arrowverse. Like, I think his character arc has been the best written of any character they've done. And it's just been so subtle, but it builds very naturally. So from the first time we met him and he was killing people with his gold gun to this episode literally calling Sarah and Rip their friends, like, it's believable. And I thought that was kind of amazing. And McRory, like, does not take well to it. He wants to stay in Star City 2046 and keep his awesome new fur coat and be a big crime boss. And Snart is not having it. So it seems like those two have completely diverged, and Mick has finally kind of realized it, because he realizes that Leonard actually has more hero in him than anyone thought. And he's like, you actually want to save the world. Like, what is wrong with you? And that just, he's so great. What a great character arc.
Yeah. Snart is what makes Legends of Tomorrow work for me. If they tried to make that show without him, I don't think it has near I would not have near as much affection for it. He just constantly is a source of not only the comedy and the funny and the, you know, the lightheartedness, but he also, as you've said, has a really great arc. Like, he has such character development every episode. He is the best part of that show. Whether, you know, he's the best in the whole Arrowverse is, you know, yet to be determined for me, but I was a little hesitant going into Legends of Tomorrow, but just watching him, especially him and Mick, kind of figuring out where they fit into this ragtag group of, you know, crazy people, it's just been so much fun, and I am loving where his character is going. So I definitely am all there for Leonard.
Yeah, he is really great, and just constant applause for the way he has developed. I love it.
So, and I loved the shout out last week in The Flash in Earth 2 to Mayor Snart.
Yes, yes.
I was so like I was giggling and jumping up and down. I was like, Karen! So yeah, Love it.
But I was, my first thought was like, oh my god, Captain Cold's mare. And then I was, my second thought was, what if it's Lisa?
Yeah, that would be even crazier. Yeah.
That would be funny. But yeah, so great. It was like, too bad we didn't get to see Mare Snart, but Wentworth Miller's a little busy.
Yeah, he's a busy guy.
All right, so that pretty much sums up all our TV thoughts. Any other thoughts before we move on?
No, I think we hit all the major ones.
All right, well then let's go on to movies. So we're going to start with our brief history here that Danya has written up on Everett Ross. So our brief history is this. Everett Ross worked for the U.S. State Department as an escort for foreign diplomats when they visited America. He was eventually assigned to T'Challa, the ruler of Wakanda, and escorted him during his time in New York City. He learned about Wakandan culture and history from Zuri, one of T'Challa's companions, and eventually became a foremost expert on everything to do with the African nation, including speaking on their behalf at the White House and advising the government on relations with Wakanda. Ross was so trusted by T'Challa in particular that he was at one point made regent of Wakanda. So we're telling you about Everett Ross because it has been revealed that that is who Martin Freeman is playing in Civil War. So he has this big connection to T'Challa, who is, of course, Black Panther. And if he has this big, if he has a role in Civil War, we can probably assume that he's going to have a pretty big role in the Black Panther movie coming out in a couple of years. So that's interesting to know. And the scope of this movie just keeps getting wider and wider.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Yeah. Martin Freeman. This should be good. I mean, like, he's so great, but just the general scope of Civil War is so big now that I'm like, okay, I just want to see it now and figure out how I feel about all of the crazy that is bound to happen with all of these characters being in one place.
And speaking of crazies, the Russos said that Civil War is going to have a controversial, dramatic ending, which I have to assume is related to the ending of the Civil War storyline in the comics. I don't know if we actually want to say what that was, but there's a very big death in the comics, and I am getting the feeling that they're gonna stay loyal to that with the films.
Yeah. I'm with you. I don't know if we actually want to say it, but if you do any sort of digging and pay any attention to things on the internet, I'm sure you know what we're talking about.
Yes, I'm sure most everybody listening to this podcast knows what we mean, but just in case, we'll just hold off. So I have a feeling that the movie's going to kind of end with, maybe not end, but kind of close to the end, is going to have that death, which would be controversial. And really what they say is it's going to change the MCU with an extreme shift. And that specific death would have a very extreme shift. So
most definitely, yes.
So I'm going to go into the movie expecting that. And if it doesn't happen, I can be pleasantly surprised. And if it does happen, I'll just be like, well, I thought it was coming.
At least I expected it.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, so that is not close enough, in my opinion. I need that soon. but on the other side, on the DC side, just because there's not enough R-rated superhero, apparently, because Deadpool was a massive success, Batman v Superman is getting an R rating on its Ultimate Edition Blu-ray for violence, which is interesting. It's not like language or anything, it's violence. So they are cutting out enough violence for an R rating for what's going to be in theaters. So Deadpool, I guess.
Now, yeah, basically it's thanks Deadpool. Now we're going to actually see the dead bodies as opposed to just, you know, seeing them fly through the air and then cut away. Like, basically, I'm imagining that's a lot of what's going to be shown, is you'll see a lot more of the effects of the violence rather than just we're, you know, fighting, blah, blah, blah. You know, random people are dead, but we're not going to show you. Because a lot of times in PG-13, that's what they cut away. They just cut away and let you assume that that person died and that it was grotesque and awful. But they don't show you, so they can keep their PG-13 rating. So
yeah, we saw like in Age of Ultron too, like we assume a whole bunch of people were killed and all that, but it wasn't like graphic.
Exactly.
So yeah, you can make the assumption, but let's, you know, ignore the fact that the reason that Deadpool worked so well and was R-rated has nothing to do with the violence and everything to do with who the character is, but you know, whatever. So if you want even more violence in your Batman v Superman, hold out for the Ultimate Edition Blu-ray because you'll get it. But it's also interesting to note that Batman v Superman isn't even out yet, and they're already setting a filming date for the first Justice League movie. They're going to start filming it in April, just after Batman v Superman comes out. But that's curious because apparently, rumor has it that the studio is not super happy with the film, that they don't think it's, quote, the springboard into Justice League they wanted it to be. So the big standout apparently is Ben Affleck, which is interesting because that was kind of a controversial choice. But the more I've seen of him in the trailers, kind of the more I've been into him as Bruce Wayne, but we shall see. But here it's interesting that apparently the studio isn't super happy with how this movie has turned out. And that is not good sign going into it being released in about a month.
Yeah, definitely not a good sign. I was on the, you know, I wasn't on the Batfleck is horrible train when that all happened. I reserve judgment because Ben can act, like he's a decent actor. So I was, you know, hoping he could bring something to the role that they, you know, saw something in him. So I'm glad to see that he's not the worst part of this movie. I'm pretty sure everyone assumed he would be. I'm more nervous about Lex.
Oh my God, I can't.
At first I was very excited because I thought he could do something interesting with the character, but after seeing what's in the trailers and whatnot, I'm really nervous about that now. So that's probably my most concerning part of this movie for me now. I will never understand
the wig. It looks like they borrowed it from season one of Arrow, and I'm going to be staring at it for the whole movie.
It's the Island wig.
It's bald anyway. It's going to be bad.
Yeah, it's just the way he was playing him, the animation that he gave to Lex Luthor, it bugs me. Yeah. Then again, I was a Smallville addict and I love what Rosenbaum did with Lex, so that's just me.
My Lex has always been the one from the DC animated television universe, and he's has a lot of gravitas and this really deep voice, and the gravitas of Lex in the animated universe is incredible, and like he towers over you and is very physically imposing. And then you've got Jesse Eisenberg, who looks like Ben Affleck or Henry Cavill could like step on him.
Like he looks like Captain America before Falcon's the Machine. And then you've got Ben Affleck and Cavill who are like huge. And I'm just like, what is happening? Because even Rosenbaum compared to Welling, like they were very equal. Like they were very big guys, and so you never really thought anything of his size, but he just Eisenberg looks so small next to them, and I'm like, oh my gosh, guys, how is this gonna work? So yeah, it's concerning, but you know, it's never a good sign that the studio is not happy. I'm surprised that they are so gung-ho about Justice League and pushing that forward if they're not happy, but apparently there's enough there that they think they can still make the other. So
yeah, there were some rumors that a solo Batman movie would get nudged into the original Justice League slot, the one that they think that Ben Affleck's probably going to direct, but apparently not. So we'll see. But that movie comes out in about a month, and we'll have thoughts then, too.
Yeah, we'll have a lot of thoughts, yeah. I'm sure.
All right, so that's it for the news. Again, not a ton. I think the studios are kind of holding on to their news until right before the movies come out. So let's move on to Comic Corner, which Danya kindly wrote up for us. She wanted to write a recommendation for Matthew, who asks, Oh my gosh, I already ship Spidey Pool so hard, and I just heard about it from Hero Hype. Please tell me where I can read about it. So Spidey Pool is, of course, Spider-Man and Deadpool. So Danya has her recommendations. She says, Spider-Man and Deadpool have met pretty sporadically over the years across a handful of titles. Their interactions have varied between bemusement, friendly, and, well, and antagonistic, but have always been an entertaining, mostly due to their differing ideals. Though it is also at points kind of tragic. Deadpool certainly has romantic feelings for Spider-Man, but their friendship, which isn't always a friendship, can be fraught, as Deadpool has zero qualms with killing. Definitely worth exploring and reading about, especially with the current crossover run happening. So here's a list of their most notable appearances together in the comics thus far. So she has a list that includes Deadpool number 7, Cable and Deadpool number 24, Amazing Spider-Man number 611, 695, and Annual number 38, Deadpool number 19, Deadpool Suicide Kings number 3 through 5, Identity Wars, Deadpool's Art of War number 2 through 4, Deadpool Kills the Marvel Universe number 2. That is a great title.
I was thinking that too. I was like, best title ever.
Avenging Spider-Man number 12, number 13, Inferior Deadpool number 10, Deadpool Annual number 2, and Spider-Man/Deadpool, which appears to be a current run. So these will all be in the show notes. And these are Donnie's recommendations for Spidey Pool. So hopefully that gives you somewhere to start, Matthew. All right. So quickly, some feedback, which is pretty much all from Cassie this week. So thank you for writing, Cassie. She is really excited about Barry's showdown with King Shark, saying it looked something like something right out of a comic book. So epic. I love this. You want to get the next one?
Sure. She also says, opening of Arrow. Wow. They already embedded something in her spine and she's recovered enough to try walking. Yeah.
Yeah. We're not happy about it either, Cassie.
Yeah. It's like I refer to what we said earlier. Yeah. We pretty much...
There's only so much hate we can direct at it without repeating ourselves too much. Yeah. I'm sure Danya will be happy to hear this, that Cassie just read She-Hulk, Law and Disorder based on The Wreck Forever Ago. So glad the library got it in. Jennifer Walters rocks. I have not read any She-Hulk, but apparently I need to add it to my list. And would you like to read that last comment?
Sure. She says, I agree with you ladies on Wynn. Maybe he can change, but for now, based on everything we've seen of him, I found him to be wildly inappropriate and creepy and cringeworthy. To say he's completely unredeemable would be pushing things too far, but he's definitely not been likable as of yet. Then again, this is coming from a girl who has had way too many guys not take rejection well and have insisted that I'm a bitch for friend-zoning them.
Yes, so the Wynn debate continues. What are your thoughts on Wynn, Kristen?
I mean, I find him, especially at the beginning of the series, I found him quite endearing, especially like having to go up against James. It's not really a competition, but it is a competition in Wynn's mind. Having to go up against James for Kara's affections, I always felt bad for him because I knew that he would never feel like he measured up, even though Kara never saw him in that way. Anyway, I personally really feel for the guy. I like him. I think he's a decent character. I was a little annoyed with how upset he was with Kara when she like let him down and basically friend-zoned him. But in the last, you know, few interactions we've seen, he's starting to get past that. And I'm, you know, I want to see them be friends. I want him to get past this crush that he's got, and I want them to be close because I think they would be an amazing, you know, male-female friendship. We don't get enough of that on TV. It always gets dragged through the romantic, you know, relationship muck. And if we can get that out of the way in season one of Supergirl, and Wynn and her can go on to have a really close friendship and be there for each other, I would be totally on board with that. So I'm reserving my... You know, I'm reserving total judgment on Wynn until we see more from him, but I'm hoping that eventually he'll get to a better place.
Well, there you go, guys. Not everybody we bring on the show has to agree with us. Chris.it.
It's all good.
Okay. And to wrap up, we are just going to go over our question of the week. Last week, we asked, which character would you love to see cross over on Legends of Tomorrow next? Because we were looking forward to seeing Oliver. Cassie tells us she'd love to see Harrison Wells cross over just because she loves Tom Cavanaugh and how he portrays the character and all the different versions of him. It probably wouldn't make any sense in the show, but I just love him. So, like to see some Harrison Wells.
Yeah, I mean, come on, Harry. It would be interesting. And which version of Harrison would it be? Because there are, you know, a few to choose from.
Also true.
So, yeah.
All right. And our question for the next week, hopefully we'll get a few more responses. We would like to know, in honor of Vixen appearing on Arrow, if you could channel the powers of any animal, what animal would it be? So let us know on Twitter at Hero Hype Podcast, or email at herohypepodcast@gmail.com. And if you would like to, if you really like the show, you could go on iTunes and rate us, hopefully 5 stars. Let help other people find us. But I think that does it. Thank you again, Kristen, for joining us. That was great.
Thanks for having me. It was lots of fun.
And I'm sure we'll be on soon again.
Oh, yeah.
And until next week, when Danya should be back, I'm Caitlin.
And I'm Kristen.
Bye, guys.
Bye.